transmitter was seeing a near short circuit, a very high standing wave ratio, and very little was being transmitted. Does that make a little more sense now, Bill? ACQIS, KQLIW on the deck net.
That does make sense. And I guess then the idea is that you did not run out of electrons in the antenna, but that things were sort of shorted in free space. Okay. You should be able to, I guess, drop carrier very briefly in order to correct that situation. Is that right? Or would it take some larger amount of time for the situation to correct? And again, should we assume or not assume that free space has electrons not associated with atoms just floating through it?
If that Mercury space capsule was very far out into space where the vacuum is very hard, and if none of the materials near the vicinity of that antenna were outgassing, then yes, if they dropped carrier, maybe they could stop the effect. But they were in a low Earth orbit. That capsule was continuously striking air molecules, obvious by the fact that you and I can measure the rate of decay of that orbit that that space capsule was in. When the space shuttle is in orbit around the Earth, every day or so they have to do a burn to reestablish the orbit because they're touching the top of the atmosphere continuously. So that atmosphere consists of, pick a number, air molecules, ions, whatever. So there's continuous things striking the antenna in the vicinity of the antenna. And when one single electron boils off one half of that dipole, and on that half cycle, jumps over to the other half by electrostatic attraction, hits with a high enough velocity to release two electrons, and you eventually get an avalanche. You get a huge cloud of electrons bouncing back and forth between the two halves of the dipole, acting as a short circuit, acting as a dummy load, increasing the standing wave ratio fiercely of the transmitter. Less and less power is being transmitted. That's not being dissipated. Let me drop. And a logical person would say, well, we're eventually going to run out of electrons on those two antennas. There's no way in hell. You try to drain the electrons out of the piece of copper cable that's between the battery of your automobile and the starter motor. If Mother Nature would allow you to drain those free electrons, one free electron on the outer orbit of each individual copper molecule, you try to drain those electrons while your starter motor is drawing 200 amperes. That's a lot of electrons per second. That's a 200 coulombs per second, I guess, is what's literally flowing. It would take you 4 hours to drain the electrons out of that copper cable between your car battery and the starter motor. You'd be amazed how many electrons are there. So you think you're going to boil away all the electrons that are on the two halves of the dipole of that antenna? No way in hell. And you think you're going to kill the carrier that will remove the multi-factor cloud that's sucking up all this RF energy and then retransmit again? Well, you got continuous air molecules at that low altitude orbit continuously available to start the process all over again. You've got to choose the right high work function materials that you coat the antenna with so that you don't get that effect. And very soon after that first Mercury or the second Mercury capsule, they corrected that effect when they finally figured out what was going on. They knew how many watts they're transmitting, they knew what the sensitivity was on the receiving antenna on the ground, and they were getting a signal roughly 20 decibels weaker, 100 times weaker than it was supposed to be. Something was really bad, somebody was eating their lunch, and that was a life-threatening situation, and they did that investigation real fast, and boy, were they surprised with what they found out. AC2IS, K2LIW on the TechNet.
W-H-1-Y-Y.
Too bad you're not listening on this particular repeater, Bill. Okay. Looks like we're back in operation here. I heard everything you said, Bill, by listening to what was being repeated on 147.375, even though this machine had a dropout for some reason. Let me drop. Looks like if I turn the machine on by coming to 975.375, I can continue talking on 25. Interesting. So, you're sort of saying, Bill, that if you're in the hard vacuum of space, could the stop process never be initiated? And the answer is maybe, but maybe not. Right now, if I count the number of cosmic rays striking your fingernail, it's a huge number. So Are there free electrons in the hard vacuum of space? Absolutely. By way of those cosmic rays, which I believe, by the way, are a big factor in the way lightning propagates, but that's another whole discussion. So, and are those cosmic rays allowing the radio waves to be transmitted? I know we're about to be going there, and I don't think that's a big factor. So, there are always going to be an occasional particle that comes along when you've got this dangerous experiment. You've got these very poor multi-factor materials of your dipole. You're transmitting a 2-gig signal from it. You want to talk to the ground with your system, and you happen to be at the high altitude, high vacuum of space, and you pray that a cosmic ray doesn't come along, strike the antenna, free up an electron, and then start the multi-factor process. Don't bet on that one, Bill. You're going to lose that bet. Mother Nature has got a lot of randomness. She's going to supply those free electrons by hook or by crook, by cosmic rays, by gamma rays, by air molecules, by plasma. There's always something around that's going to come along, and one single electron can kick off this process if you've got the wrong materials of that antenna. The right solution is to use the right materials. Other than that, I don't think you've got a solution that you can depend on, Bill. ACQIS, K2LIW, and if you're not coming to this, pick up within 1.5 seconds, Bill, K2LIW.
Great conversation. But I think even without the cosmic rays, I think I could say that your interstellar capacitor there could have electrons disturbed on either side that would account for an electric field in freaky space. Maybe some other people out there would agree or disagree with that. Back to that.
KQ2QIQ. Okay, the machine's back on. The total number of cosmic rays, would they really support a radio wave, is sort of what we're getting at here now. And I think the answer is no. The number of cosmic rays is large. The total number of electrons that it can supply at any one instant of time in any cubic centimeter of space, I think is a very small number. And so the number of electrons required to support the E-field hypothesis of the current model being used for what a TEM wave in free space looks like. I'm having a lot of trouble with that one. Although I don't think so. Glenn, let's see, I knew I had to add something to this one. And by the way, looks like we've almost burned through the time that we should have been using on the mailbag. Here we go. The mailbag. Oh, well. And I know we've got Lou, N2LU, who hasn't had his chance yet. And by the way, Lou, the promise we make at the beginning for TechNet, for people who sign in the beginning, we promise them that they will have at least a brief answer in the first hour or so. You were an unfortunate guy who signed in much, much later. Therefore, you were not part of that list. And so, in theory, we haven't violated our promise, if you know what I mean there, Lou. We're going to, if you're still there, Lou, we're going to try to get to you. And if at worst we don't get to you tonight, you're going to be number one on the runway next week. Glenn, KQ2QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn. I just transmitted on 375 to start it back up, so go ahead, Glenn. Pick up in a hurry. Unfortunately, Glenn, every bit of that didn't come through the machine. I heard every bit of it by way of what gets coupled to the 147-375 machine. There's something going on tonight where, as we drop this machine for a long enough period of time, it drops out, and the only way I can get it to come back on is to make a brief transmission on 375. So, Jeff, relay to CDL.
R-C-2-N, repeater controller, D-5.2846. R-C-2-N, repeater controller, D-5.2846. The time is 10:17 p.m. The time is 10:17 p.m. Ready. Welcome.
Okay, so we're back in operation. Andy with W2CDL just reset the machine. Everything that you said, Glenn, did not come through. I heard you on what got coupled to 147.375, but you'll have to repeat what you just said, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Very good, Dick. I'm coming through on the 375 machine. Can you hear me here?
Yeah, we're hearing you very well. So I guess that's one. You can go back to the 2585 right now and have the normal conversation, Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, as long as I'm making it through, I think I'll stay here just for now. At least I'll, where's that? If I have two items in space, a mass on one side, charge on one side of free space, or with a vacuum separating those two masses, I can increase the charge on one, and without touching the other one on the other side, and the differential charge difference between those two items has increased. So the differential voltage between those two masses across a vacuum would be increased. And I didn't really have to touch the other side. And where I could add or subtract charge from the other side and create a difference in differential charge across that vacuum, and still basically the voltage would shift. So I do believe you can change it on one side. And when it comes to the E-field, if I have a variation in charge on one side of a vacuum, the differential voltage between that change in charge on one side of the vacuum as opposed to the other side is still a differential voltage. So I still think that the E field can be varying across the vacuum, but its exact distribution cycle by cycle, I'm just not really clear on what that is yet. K2RW, KC2QX2.
I'm going to agree with you, Glenn, that I can have two metallic objects in space. I either put charge on only one, or I put a positive charge, one, and a negative charge on the other. By one means or another, I have a difference in charge between the two objects. And now you and I want to determine what is the voltage. We put some kind of a voltmeter between the two, and there's the catch. The voltmeter has to consider one of the two objects as reference and let it to measure the voltage of the other. If the one that I'm applying the charge to, let's assume I've got two metallic objects in space that are both uncharged, and I put my voltmeter between the two, and I measure 0 volts. And my grounded lead of my voltmeter is the one that's the upper one, the upper of the two metallic objects, and I'm now going to pour the charge into the upper metallic object. Yes, I will measure a voltage between the two, but as far as the voltmeter is concerned, the grounded lead just got moved. It's the equivalent of you and I creating a ground loop. Even though we ground our equipment to the safety wiring, the round pin in the wall, and we think now we know that everything is at the same reference. Well, depending on the way the resistance between that and the rest of the universe takes place and how much current I'm pouring into it, you can move that so-called ground. The word ground is a relative thing. But so in our two metallic objects in space, there is a one is a reference to the other. So there's only a fixed amount of capacitance between the two. You're pouring a finite amount of charge in Coulomb into one or both differentially, but you're doing something differentially. Q equals CV. So once I know the capacitance, once I know the Q that you put on, I know the voltage I've created between the two. And so since one is reference to the other, to say that I'm creating an E field in space, you're right. And even though I'm putting the charge on the so-called grounded lead, as far as my voltmeter is concerned, even if I reverse the voltmeter lead and now read the opposite potential, I'll get the same answer. So it is the relation between the two metallic objects and the relation between the two individual charges and the relation between the capacitance between the two that determines the differential voltage that I measure. Another crazy experiment I could do is I got these two metallic objects. Let me drop. I got these two metallic objects in free space. I put 1 coulomb of charge on the upper object. I put 1 coulomb of charge on the lower object, positive charge in both cases. My voltmeter between the two will measure 0. If I now put the voltmeter between either one of those charges and what I call Earth or the rest of the universe, yes, I'll measure a voltage. So, as I see it, voltage is a differential phenomenon, which is a function of differential charge between two usually metallic objects that are separated by some distance, which constitute a certain capacitance between the two. But the capacitance assonance between the two, in my mind, is not required to transmit a radio wave. I don't have to have a finite capacitance between that Voyager antenna, 80 billion kilometers away from me, and the capacitance of my antenna on Earth. I don't have to have a finite capacitance between the two to transmit that radio wave. And yes, that antenna on Voyager has a certain capacitance to the universe, and my antenna on the ground has a certain capacitance to the universe. And that is a fixed capacitor through a very long path. And that path being so long, I would have to wait much more than 33 hours if that's what's creating the signal between the two. The round path signal between me and Voyager is 33 hours right now. And so another phenomenon is taking place. It's not capacitor. It's bundles of energy that you and I call the TEM wave in my mind. KQQIQ, KQLIW.
I have to agree with you on this, Nick, because here's what I'm thinking. The only reason why I'm bringing up what that capacitance that's there is because I'm always troubled by going back to Maxwell's equation. In other words, how do I create in that equation, in other words, I need to get angular rotation. I need to have a continuous wave where I can actually generate the E field and the H field. And there's got to be a distribution on a cycle-by-cycle basis. Going from one location across a vacuum to the other side. What's interesting is that if I assume a vacuum that's differential, with a differential voltage across it, that is enough to satisfy Maxwell's equation. But is it required as far as the reception antenna or the transmitting antenna? No, because they're coupling the magnetic signal coming through the antenna, creating the current on either side, and or the current leaving the transmitting antenna, turning the magnetic cycle on the other side. So at the moment of arrival and at the moment of transition, it's really electric to directly to magnetic, and the exact opposite effect happening right on the other on the reception antenna, where it's taking the magnetic and turning it back into electrical on that end. But in between, as long as I have the differential voltage over space and define that difference, then I can satisfy Maxwell's equation. I think that's just really where I'm going with it, and it might make the model a little bit closer. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
The differential voltage across space that you're referring to, Glenn, if my antenna on the 2 gigahertz ham band where I'm listening to the astronauts, where the wavelength is 4.5 inches, my half-wave dipole is 2.25 inches long, the differential voltage across space that matters to me is the differential voltage across the 2.5 inches of that dipole that I'm using to receive for the Apollo astronauts. And that magnetic field that hits that chunk of space, encompassing that metallic conductor 2.25 inches long, induces a voltage that my receiver sees. So the voltage that I care about is the voltage field across the 2.5 inches of that dipole when I'm receiving. The voltage that exists between me and that astronaut 250,000 miles away on the moon, that voltage doesn't count. That signal is coming at me at 2,000 megacycles per second. Each one of those signals has a wavelength of 4.5 inches. This 4.5 inches, these expanding bubbles of the transmitted wave on the moon coming back down to the Earth, those expanding wave bubbles, if each one of those bubbles represents the next cycle out of the transmitting antenna. Each of those bubbles are inside of each other, expanding at the speed of light, and the consecutive bubbles are 4.5 inches apart. That's the wavelength and the rate of transmission, if you know what I mean. So as that portion of the bubble that's approximately 2.5 inches wide, that portion of the bubble, a 2.5 inch square, I'm going to say, on a side, 2.5 inches on a side square, that hits my dipole, my very simple receiver. That's what counts. And so the real E field between that transmitting antenna on the moon and the receiving antenna on the Earth with a 250,000 mile repeater, timeout, cancel, with a 250,000 miles separating them, that E field, in my opinion, doesn't count. It's billions and billions of cycles away. In other words, the moon is, in that 250,000 miles, there's billions of radio cycles between what they're transmitting and what I receive. I'm getting the information 1.25 seconds late. I'm getting old news, if you know what I mean. the data I get, because of the distance between the two, is a quarter of a second, one and a quarter seconds old. Round trip to the moon is 2.5 seconds. So I'm getting data 1.25 seconds late. I'm getting data a billionth of cycles downrange from what they're transmitting at this instant. And that little portion of that wave, each portion of the bundle has a finite amount of energy. I care about the chunk of energy that's across the 2.5-inch square. That chunk of energy hits my antenna as a cyclic magnetic field in my simplistic model. That cyclic magnetic field hits the conductor of my antenna and induces a voltage in my antenna by Faraday's law or Lenz's law. That's one possible approach of this, what I'm hypothesizing as a newer model. KTQQIQ, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I think we're in most parts here in agreement that, as far as, you know, that voltage and that counting in terms of what the reception and the transmission signal are, because through that last part of the H magnetic field that's intersecting the antenna, where the real signal is coming from, and the same thing on the transmission end. But I guess it's just, you know, how do we explain how does the first cycle, or the first bubble in this model, move the second bubble? Because what's happening is that if one bubble is geometrically in one dimension, now the next wave has to propel the next cycle. So in water, it's fairly simple, because what's happening is you're creating a motion in a body of fluid that's moving something in one direction, and then you've got the reset action mechanically of that ball moving back up again that propels the wave. In electromagnetics, the problem here is that once you generate the H field in one direction and then you spin it around the other way, that causes the propulsion to the second bubble. And the E field makes a beautiful coupling, so to speak, between the two. So there is some interreaction between E and H to keep angular rotation moving and the wave moving out. So as long as I have a vector that's pointing in a direction towards the other antenna, even though it's not the actual intersecting voltage that the antenna sees, it's still satisfying the wave model that allows the signal to propel in one direction and those bubbles to keep on moving outward from the transmission source. Thank you. The K2R does the K2QIQ.
You brought up a very interesting point, Glenn, and I've got a very different point of view. You're assuming that the individual bubbles have to be pushed by the next bubble inside. I say absolutely not. And I've done an experiment that gives a strong piece of evidence in the other direction. By the same token, I can be pushing that basketball up and down in the middle of the lake, and I'm creating these individual waves, and those waves spread out with a very predictable amount of energy. As they increase in diameter, that's where the energy is going. They're not really being dissipated. They come over to the shore and you measure them. There's nothing stopping me from pushing the beach ball only once. I make one single wave, and it travels out in the exact same way, and there are no other consecutive waves behind it pushing it. So there's the lake experiment. Now I'm going to give you the radio experiment. Let me drop. I personally stood in the middle of the Benningfield anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, 1990, and I was generating pulses of energy at, let me pick a rough number, the kilowatt level, at 10 gigahertz, and I was making those pulses 250 picoseconds long. Each individual pulse was a quarter of a nanosecond long. Each pulse that I transmitted was three complete cycles of 10 gigs, and then stopped. Each individual pulse. I know how strong they were when I transmitted. I know how strong they were received 150 feet away. The calculation of signal strength fit, even though there were only three cycles there. So there wasn't a whole bunch of bubbles pushing against each other. In theory, I could have gone to a lower frequency with the exact same pulse width. But my equipment could generate a pulse a quarter of a nanosecond long, and at that time I couldn't generate a pulse any more brief. If I went to one-third the frequency, 3 gigs instead of 10 gigs, I would have been generating one single pulse. and I know that pulse would go across that space of 1,000 wavelengths. You know, 1 inch was the wavelength, and 150 feet, 1,500 wavelengths approximately. 1,500 wavelengths away is where my receiving antenna was, and so I know I could transmit one single pulse. There would be no consecutive bubbles pushing against each other, and that one single pulse would still be received with full amplitude. It would still propagate at exactly the speed of light. Once you generate one single pulse of energy, one single bubble, one single cycle of transmitted RF energy, let me drop. All the evidence that I have, Glenn, tells me that one single cycle of RF properly transmitted all by itself propagates out into space at exactly the right speed, at exactly the right speed, at exactly the right inverse square law fall off of energy versus distance. It doesn't require the individual bubbles behind it pushing against it. And we all think up till now that in that wave itself, that H field energy and E field energy is trading back and forth like it does with an LC circuit sitting on a wooden table. I say absolutely not. I say that energy is not transferring back and forth. The evidence doesn't support that. Therefore, I'm of the opinion that the magnetic field is the majority of energy of that bubble, and only in the near field can I sense so-called near field electrostatic effects. When I get into the far field of the antenna, that E field dies out. The magnetic field in my simplistic model is what is the real bubble, the real energy that propagates out. And whether it be a wave from a beach ball going toward the shore, or whether it be a single electromagnetic wave from my antenna, one wave all by itself does it, Glenn. It doesn't need the other ones pushing it. You've launched it. Once you've launched it, it wants to propagate at exactly the speed of light. It wants to move out exactly like a bubble. Why it wants to do that, I'm going to admit that that's damn complicated. We ain't there yet. TC2QIQ, T2LIW.
Big map.
Yeah, I think basically we're on the same page here. I might have not completely explained it the way that you just did right there, but I think you're absolutely right. The magnitude of E and H are maximum at the maximum point and minimum at the minimum point. So yes, they're vectors, not phase shifts. That's correct, and they're taking place with the direction with a vector from the source to the reception antenna. So that is the forward direction of that TEM wave. Now what's interesting is that in that model, in order for the one thing nice about Maxwell's equation and the voltage and the charge equation is that it gives you that instantaneous pulse that allows it to move at the speed of light. The problem with just magnetic fields by itself, you know, that's the problem that I'm having with the angular rotation, is that if you just have one pulse of a magnetic field, what propels it? It's like if you take a magnet and you take another magnet and you rotate, you run towards another magnet and the field repels itself. That is easily understood. But how does it propel? It doesn't. It's static at that point. But once you have an E field around the H field in a vector direction moving away from the source, then it becomes much easier to explain, and then you can use charge to explain the differential in charge over distance of what's actually propelling that magnetic bubble through space. So like you said, you don't have to continuously deliver with waves to have that keep on moving away, because it's actually displaced across a voltage and charge over distance with that magnetic field moving it, so with its intensity. And it travels across space in inverse square law. It's really kind of cool stuff. KC2QIQ. I think somebody else wants to pick it up here.
Grant, you said that there's a vector from the transmitting antenna toward the receiving antenna. I disagree. In the model that we've used, the E field vector is a bunch of lines representing the E field. They're at right angles to the direction of propagation. The H field lines as a vector are a bunch of lines at right angles to the direction of propagation. The tips of all of those individual vectors create an envelope that you and I look at as the sine wave of E field or the sine wave of H field. So the vectors of the wave itself, the E and the H, are at right angles to the direction of propagation. The so-called pointing vector that goes from the transmitting antenna toward the receiving antenna is a man-made concept that explains E course age and the direction of propagation in our particular model. There is no vector per se from the transmitting antenna toward the receiving antenna. Obvious by the fact that with an isotropic antenna, it isotropically is an expanding bubble that hits every plane in space simultaneously. You can put the receiving site a mile away across this 1 mile radius sphere, and you've got one receiving site every square 1 degree. There's 41,000 square degrees on the surface of the sphere. Let me drop. I create the sphere 1 mile in radius, and I put 41,000 receiving antennas. Each one represents 1 degree of azimuth and 1 degree of elevation, if you want to mean. There's 41,000 square degrees on the surface of the sphere. I put one receiving antenna in each one of those square degrees. Every one of them will pick up the exact same amount of energy if I have an isotropic antenna. So there isn't a real vector going from your transmitter to your receiver. It's an expanding bubble going everywhere in space. Now, with a directive antenna, the bubble is stronger and brighter in certain directions, but it still is a complete bubble. You launch that wave, and it propagates. Why Mother Nature does that? That's a tough one. But it doesn't require the successive bubbles inside pushing against it. I can clap my hands once. I make a puff of air. It's a sound wave that goes out in space, one single event. I can clap my hand a whole lot of times, and I'm creating a whole bunch of bubbles of air pressure. And you could think that the individual bubbles are pushing against each other. I don't think so. I clap my hand once, you'll hear that sound. That one single wave will propagate through that medium, whether it be sound in air, whether it be a single wave on the lake of water, or whether it be an electromagnetic wave, and with my very brief pulsing device, I could generate one single RF cycle and then stop. And that single RF cycle, one single bubble, will spread out in space and do its thing. So that pointing vector, in my opinion, Glenn, is not a real vector. It's a man-made concept of E cross H. The E and the H are both at right angle vectors to the direction of propagation. KC2QIQ, KQLIW on the tech net.
KC2IS for the comment?
Yeah, that was definitely that breaking station IA recognized. I agree with you completely, Dick. I mean, the vector that I was speaking of is just an analytical direction. That we're looking at cross sections at the other end, but you're right, the physical model is the bubble. They are, propagating exactly as you said. So that, I believe, is okay. It's just trying to explain that E field with the H field and the proportions. But I still am convinced that there is a proportion to E and H across the whole electromagnetic wave and those bubbles to create the angular rotation. But I just don't really have the grasp of what the E field looks like on each side. But I think, other than that, Dick, I think we're pretty much in agreement on most everything else. You think you have another breaking station, Dick? I'm going to pass it back to you. KQRW, KQRW.
I'm going to pass it over to Bill in a minute. When it comes to the 377 ohms of space, there's another whole. The ratio of the magnitude of H versus the magnitude of E are related by 377 ohms. And that is like ohms per square. And you can buy scrimshaw material, sold by Emerson Cumming, among other companies. It's thin material with carbon granules deposited on this thin sheet of material. And you can buy it at 50, 100, 200, 370, 1,000 ohms per square. Free space has what looks like a sheet of thin material at 377 ohms per square. And I'll get into that on the next transmission. Bill wants to say something. ACQIS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, this is ACQIS. Two things. Just wanted to point out that you guys were talking on top of each other for a while there, maybe for first half of sixth, second to last transmission there. And then the other thing, it seems like it's impossible for me to figure out what a polarization of an isotropic antenna might be. If you guys could correct me if I'm wrong on that, please do.
And WS21.
Okay, we've got into a real good set of subjects here. We're going to break away temporarily. Let's let Paul give us a space report. And I'm going to let John decide whether or not we should. I think we should definitely have a John mailbag. Paul first, because what happened with the launch, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2LAW. You got it, Paul.
I had a very good idea. When the other machine dropped out, I was wondering what happened there. But that was the time killer. Dragon and Falcon 9 took off. Falcon 9 being the rocket, Dragon being the spacecraft. And it successfully went up. 9 rockets, they call them Merlin rockets, in the first stage, all fired. And it went through main engine cutoff. Actually, two rockets shut off on purpose, a little on the early side, and then the other 7 rockets cut out. That to make it a smooth transition. And then what happens is that stage separates, and then another identical Merlin rocket, which is the first stage has 9, the second stage has 1. That thing lit off and got it to orbit. That fired for about 6 minutes. And then Dragon separated from that. Solar panels came out, 6,000 watt generating solar panels successfully came out. The front of the spacecraft automatically separates, and that was good, 100% successful launch. And Wednesday, will be approaching the space station, and the commander will grab a hold of it with the robot arm and then dock it to the Omni node, and then they'll be able to get their 1,000 pounds worth of stuff out of it. So we talked about the private mission a little bit last week, and there's a lot of companies now involved with this. That if you want me to go through the 5 main companies, I'll do that then, briefly, and what their agendas are, and where they are in their, what I call space race, their commercial space race, Dick, back here.
Sounds like a very successful project. Zoom back a little bit for us, Bill, because some of the people are hearing about this Dragon for the first time, so even though it's a little bit repetitive, tell us what Dragon is and what it's attached to. Make a rough guess as to how many pounds of what kind of hardware is being brought up. I presume these are, right now it's not manned at this time, but I know it's going to be manned at a later time. Consumable materials like water, oxygen, food, and other instrumentation hardware is being brought up by this mission. I'm going to guess in the vicinity of a few thousand pounds of stuff. It's going to be mating with the, it's going to be linking up with the International Space Station on Wednesday. And I think that's quicker than the normal mating period time. I believe there's something more efficient in the way that they're doing this blast off. So give us some of those words, a sort of a top down on what this whole mission is, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, all the launches, no matter if they're manned or unmanned, usually take 2 or 3 days to get to the space station. And then they dock. The Progress missions by Russia, they dock autonomously. They don't need a robotic arm. Same with the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicles from France. Not France, well, built in France, but by the European Space Agency. They dock automatically. Some of the ones that use the robotic arms are the Japanese supply mission cargo vehicle called the H-2 that gets grappled by the robotic arm by the space station and gets merged with the Omni mode. And then same with Dragon. They're the most common ways of doing it. Actually, the only 2 ways of doing it. On takeoff, the Falcon 9 and the Dragon Falcon 9 being the rocket, Dragon being the spacecraft, built by SpaceX, has flown before to the space station, dropping back in May, was the first flight. That was what they call a demo flight. And they brought up about 700 pounds at that point. And they really did that on their own. But now they're being paid. So this is really the first paid mission. They have a contract with NASA, $1.5 billion, to fly 12 missions to the space station, all cargo missions, over the next few years. It will be probably at the end of 2014, maybe early 2015. They'll have the capability of bringing up to seven astronauts with cargo. That's the way to work. This rocket is, you know, the primary design is these Merlin rockets, and they put nine of them into a Falcon launch vehicle. Eventually, they're going to have what they call the heavy Falcon lift vehicle, which is really taking three of these boosters, three nine engine rockets, like three Falcon 9s, and bumping them together, and that will be the first stage. And now have the capability of lifting a heavier payload to orbit than what the shuttle has. So that's really quite an advancement, and it's quite an ambitious group that's doing all this. Between the manned flights and the cargo flights and the heavy lift vehicles, being able to bring 20,000 pounds or so up to geosynchronous orbit if they want, with the heavy lift vehicles in the future, they're doing very good, and they're right on time. They've got all their milestones. The tone, Dick? There we go, okay. So, basically that's the rundown on SpaceX and what their future is. You've got four other companies really involved with this commercial program that's partially being funded by NASA. And eventually they'll be, you know, pretty much doing things on their own, but they'll be getting money from private corporations to put satellites in space, maybe even tourism in the far future. But in the beginning, they've got, you know, their biggest customer is really NASA. The next one that's right on the heels of SpaceX, a company called Orbital Sciences, they now have their rocket at their launch facility. And you think I'm going to say Florida, down in Cape Canaveral. And that's right. They rebuilt a whole facility down in Wallops Island, Virginia. And they're getting ready. I mean, they've got their booster down there. Their rocket is called the Antares launch vehicle. And they're going to be launching what their spacecraft called the Cygnus. Again, all built by them. This is strictly a cargo mission, you know, for all their flights. They have signed a contract with NASA for 8 flights to go to the International Space Station. Their first flight will probably be December this year. It's going to be an Antares launch with just a dummy spacecraft on board, just to see if it goes to orbit.
And repeater, timeout. Repeat.
The difference is that spacecraft is not reusable. Similar to the Progress vehicle by the Russians, that one will be loaded up with garbage and stuff that they want to throw away from the space station. It'll undock the space station and burn up over the Pacific Ocean. Similar to the Progress, and in fact, the H2 by Japan does the same thing, and the ATV, automatic transport vehicle by European Space Agency, also burns up over the Pacific Ocean. So the difference between the two is SpaceX has a reusable spacecraft that will land on the water and eventually on land. The Falcon rockets that they use will eventually bring they will bring them back to Earth. They'll fly them back on parachute, and they'll be reusable after mission six or so. They plan on doing that. The Antares is not reusable by Orbital Sciences, and the Cygnus spacecraft and the cargo spacecraft is also not reusable, and will never be manned. But the big difference here is, I mean, they really rebuilt the Wallops Island launch facility in Virginia for their own purposes. I mean, SpaceX kind of did the same thing down in Florida. I mean, it's all about fine. They really did take over this whole area of Wallops Island. Let me drop it. Not to say SpaceX is not really up on it, because right now they're almost done with rebuilding a whole facility, launch facility in California at, what's the name of it? Is it Andrews? Not Andrews. I forgot the name. But, that escapes me right now. But they built this whole facility in California. So they, both companies are spending big money on this. They have big plans in the future. And there's three other companies that are involved, but these are the two companies that are really much further along. You have Boeing. Boeing is building CST-100. That stands for Crew Space Transportation 100. And it kind of looks like the Orion spacecraft. This thing, all plans of having it manned and maybe a launch date by around 2015, and they'll be able to bring people to low Earth orbit, to International Space Station, and even to a privately built space station being built by Bigelow. He's just looking and waiting for a ride to put his space station up there. But all of these spacecraft have the capability of going to not only the International Space Station, but the future Bigelow Space Station. But Boeing is there. I mean, they've got hardware ready to go, and they'll be launched on NASA Atlas rockets, Atlas V rockets. They have the capability of also making a deal with SpaceX and launch even on a Falcon 9. So a lot of work being done. That's three. You got a fourth one called Sierra Nevada, building Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser looks like a small space shuttle. That will be able to carry space astronauts, seven of them. And that will also be launched on an Atlas V. That company's a little bit behind. I mean, they've got hardware. Their predicted date will be around 2016. Let me drop it. And another little known system that's being developed, they also have hardware developed and spacecraft almost ready to go, is called the Liberty System. That's built by ATK. ATK is a big company. I mean, they're the ones really building the rocket engines for NASA for the future Orion system. And the Space Launch System will be bigger than the Apollo. Built bigger than the Saturn rockets. And, so it's a company that's been around forever, but not many people know about it. It's called ATK and Astrium, which is a foreign group in France, headquartered in France, building all the equipment for their launches. But they have things that they're not ready to go. Give them another year and a half or so, and you're going to see those people launching launching spacecraft probably to the space station. But so you've got the Liberty System, you've got Orbital Sciences, SpaceX, and five main companies that are really involved with this. Sierra Nevada, so Boeing, Sierra Nevada, ATK. I mean, a lot of money, a lot of work a lot of people have jobs because of this system that they're doing to basically replace the space shuttle, bring astronauts up and hardware up. You know, it's better than waiting for the Orion spacecraft, probably, you know, maybe 2020 by the time they start making their missions go up. And, I mean, they'll, of course, go to the space station just for, you know, for practice, kind of. But eventually that, those spacecraft, the Orion by NASA, will be used for deep space work, not just going to low Earth orbit. And that's a rough rundown on a subject. Let me drop it. I wanted to talk about oxygen and all that. I took notes on that from last week's discussion, but I'm really eating up a lot of time here. Back to you, Dick. WS tonight.
I'm amazed how many companies are pursuing this. I had the impression, though, Paul, that most of them are doing it on their own nickel, that the only one NASA is subsidizing and funding right now is Falcon 9, Dragon, that particular mission, because it is now the leader, the one that's showing the most amount of success up to this time, and they have, I think you said, a $1.5 billion contract for the next dozen or so launches. I'm curious about whether or not any subsidizing or funding has taken place with any of the other players. I think the majority of their money is going to be coming from themselves. They're going to prove they're capable. That's question number one. Let me drop. And question number two, when it comes to the Falcon 9 and Dragon, with the Dragon, the real spacecraft now in space, it's going to be picked up by the Canadian arm that's on the larger version of the Canadian arm that's on the International Space Station. That will capture the Dragon and bring it into a docking position. And I presume that method of docking is a lot safer than the previous method of docking, where you have to do a precise alignment and ram the probe home to the capture point at the docking mechanism. I suspect that the arm doing the docking is a much safer maneuver. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW, the tech man?
Yeah, as far as the funding goes, all five, that's why I mentioned those five, the two other ones that I really didn't go into, as far as I know, they're not being funded, but they're very active, on the, more or less on their own dime, but these five have been funded each year. NASA lets out a lot of money, and so all five of these companies, and that's why they're able to progress at the rate that they are. For instance, Orbital Sciences came on board about a year and a half after SpaceX, with all their funding from NASA. And now they're only 6 months behind, so they've really accelerated. You know, you got to watch this group next. They're the ones with the unmanned flights. They're already signed up with NASA for 8 flights to the space station. And that'll be officially starting, the first demo mission will be the spring of next year for them. And then probably 4 months, 5 months later, they'll start regular flights up to the space station, being paid by NASA to do it. The development of the other companies are still, they're being funded by NASA. And as far as safety goes, I guess they consider what the progress has been doing for probably 10, 15 years or more. See, the space station's actually up there now 10 years, but the progress is no longer on that because they've been docking with the Mir. Mir was up for 15 by the Russians. And they've been docking autonomously, over 20 years now. No problem. They did have a problem one time with Mir. Using the robotic arm, it's safe. Every time this spacecraft or any of the other ones approach, they hang out about a mile and a half away from the space station, and they go through a lot of tests, communications back and forth to the spacecraft to make sure everything's working before they fly their maneuvering engines, getting closer and closer. They do have to get close within about, 50 or 60 feet to the space station automatically. And that's close. One wrong firing of an engine, and, you could have a disaster. So I'd say it's all pretty risky one way or the other, autonomously or with the robotic arm. Back to you.
To your knowledge, Paul, will there be a NASA movie or live show during the docking procedure, or was that only just during this particular blast off? How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I don't have a NASA TV. Oh, yeah, you'll have the docking. That'll be Wednesday, and then the robotic grab of the actual docking would be Wednesday, what is it, 9:30 or something in the morning, I said. But I think 9:40. So, yeah, they'll always have that. I don't know if you'll see it on the news. Quick amount of the news station. I didn't see anything real quick. But, of course, NASA TV, every little thing that they do is retransmitted. So, but it's an amazing deal. We talked about the oxygen. Last week I said that all the spacecraft, they bring up oxygen. I'm a little behind times. I mean, I checked a lot of websites over the past week there. The main source of oxygen on the International Space Station is water. It bring up a tremendous amount of water, and there's a lot of water that's been created up on the space station. The shuttle used to create water as they used their fuel cells. A lot of water was actually being created from that process to make electricity. And that water was put on board the station. True, a lot of oxygen is brought up by the shuttle and still by these other vehicles. But by the shuttle was quite a bit, and they would pump it into these big tanks presently attached to the Quest module. And I read 900 pounds. I go,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Tanks on the outside of the Quest are really kind of like a backup system that they use when they do a spacewalk. Any air that's brought, made up by these tanks, it's 14.7 pounds per square inch on board the space station. I mean, oxygen and nitrogen. They have nitrogen on board the space station as well, and these tanks that are on the outside of the Quest supply that. But the main source is really water. And they have these electrolysis machines, and they're constantly separating the two, with the hydrogen and the oxygen. And that's how they, and the Russians are doing the same thing on their side. And you would think, wow, how much water would you need? Well, I looked into it for electrolysis, that you might know this answer, but according to what I found out, 1 liter, only 1 liter of water is needed per person per day. It's a lot of water, but I mean, I thought it would have been a lot more than that through the electrolysis process. And there is a third system too as well. They have these chlorated candles. They light these candles up, and they supply oxygen as well. So that's really become a real backup system. They needed it at one time. They did have problems, and they used that quite a bit. But that was the overview on the oxygen deal. And there's one step further, and like one of the later flights that they brought up, there's a system that they put on board, which actually takes the scrubber carbon dioxide. When you exhale, carbon dioxide has to go somewhere, and it winds up in these scrubbers. Well, now they take the carbon dioxide from that, and they mix it with the hydrogen and the you have the electrolysis process, and right now they inhale the oxygen, and the hydrogen is dumped overboard. And now this new system that they have is